right? So it was very, very common that people would simply, in fact, you even find in Talmud sometimes. In Talmud, when we have in the commentaries different things that are in Rashi or the like, you'll often hear the explanation, this was inserted by some disciple who wanted to, a Talmud Torah, a disciple who didn't understand the discussion, tried to add something. There was a certain freedom in emendation of texts, which today is not considered justified, in which if you thought that, you know, Rashi didn't quite say it clearly enough, in those days, people would just add something. And later, commentaries try to differentiate what are Rashi's words, what are other words.
But we didn't have many words.
Well, it might be. But by the way, because of this, because it was getting out of hand, Rabbeinu Tam, who was Rashi's own grandson, who was the greatest rabbi in France and Germany of his generation, actually pronounced a solemn ban of excommunication on anyone who changes a text because they feel that the text, in other words, what people were doing is, gee, if this didn't make sense, they would just change the text, as opposed to the understanding that, well, you know, maybe we have to try to figure it out a little bit more. And therefore, from Rabbeinu Tam's time onwards, the tendency has been that corrections were written, or proposed emendations were written on the side, that you would not change the actual text. But until Rabbeinu Tam's time, you know, people were doing a lot of changing. And that's why if you look at Rashi and Talmud, for example, a lot of Rashi is devoted to telling you what the text should be, because sometimes texts were not accurately preserved. So be that, those are just a few words about the literary structure of the Kuzari. And once again, it refers to an event that occurred at least 300 years before Yudah Levi was even born. So this is by the time Yudah Levi writes this, there is no Khazarian kingdom anymore. They have already been conquered, so there's no one there. As it were, there's no one to blame. You can't go out and say, hey, why did you write this bad thing about Christianity? They're long gone from the scene. But the story, and again, this is the same story that is told in King Joseph's letter to Ibn Shakrut, is that King Bulan, you'll notice that king didn't have a Jewish name, but his descendants already had a Jewish name. King Bulan was a very, very religious man. He was very involved in sacrifices and in worshipping the various gods that he believed in. And angels would appear to him in dreams of the night. And they would inform him that your kavanot, your intentions are good, but your deeds are not proper. And, you know, at first he dismissed it, and then he intensified his religious observances. But he kept on getting this dream. And as a seeker of truth, he wanted to investigate what was the proper way of serving God. Okay, what was the proper way of serving God? And he summons, the three people that he summons are, he first summons the philosopher, he then summons the Christian, he then summons the Muslim, and the philosopher basically gives him the idea that God is the prime cause. There is a prime cause, this is the Aristotelian term, who causes everything to come into existence. But essentially the philosopher's idea is that the goal of life is to attach yourself to God, and that is the medium of the active intellect. Remember the active intellect? Again, it's something a little hard for us to understand, but the active intellect is like this cosmic intelligence that is out there. And by proper meditation and contemplation, you attach yourself to that active intellect, and then you are connected to the prime cause. But the philosopher's point is that the idea of mitzvah, the idea of commandment, the idea that there's anything God wants you to do, is totally meaningless. God, or the prime cause, does not know what people do. God is not involved in people's lives. There is just this prime cause, and one gets connected to the active intellect by meditation, by contemplation, by living a life of virtue. The philosopher does say that, but virtue is to be defined by one's own personal code of morality and ethics. It's kind of a subjectivist idea that by living a good life, as you have come to understand, the idea of goodness, and by focusing on mental and contemplative activity, one gets connected to the prime mover. This was the philosopher's idea. Let me just read you something from there. So, for example, on page 5, I'm just reading the Kropotkin edition. Once you have integrated this philosophy within yourself, you need not concern yourself with specific dogma, sets of rituals, or other actions, choice of words or language. If you like, you can even fabricate your own religion. Actually, I remember hearing a talk in which a rabbi was quoting from one of Harvey Cox's books about theology in America. So a young woman was interviewed in New York, whose name was Sheila, and Sheila was saying that she believes in God, but she does not believe in organized religion. She has her own religion, and she likes to call it Sheilaism, in which, you know, she worships God in her own way. So the rabbi had a comment, what would she call it if her name was Judy? Okay, but be it as it may, the idea here is that from a philosophical standpoint, the idea of mitzvah, the idea of religion, the idea of God caring what we do, the notion of a personal involvement between man and God, is something that, at least in the Aristotelian remote idea of prime cause, simply did not exist. And this is what would be called, perhaps, an antinomian view of the philosopher. Antinomian means against legalism or against law, that the notion of law, the notion of rules, the notion of ritual, the notion of precise things you have to do, are foreign to the philosopher's conception of how one connects to the prime cause. Now, this is very interesting because, in a way, this creates kind of an interesting overlap between the philosopher and the mystic. That it's been remarked that philosophy and mysticism, although very, very different in many ways, actually share a lot of common features and might be regarded as two sides of the same coin. Because the mystical experience also is one which is not focused on boundaries, right? Because mitzvot often say, however they are, whether they're Jewish mitzvot or the rituals of religion, often circumscribe and limit the appropriate ways that one relates to God. So, for example, one relates to God by eating matzah on Pesach night. Now, let's assume I'm not inspired to eat matzah Pesach. Let's assume I've been up the past week before Pesach, and I'm just not into a Seder right then. So I might say to God, well, you know, God, if you give me a week, in a week I will be able to make the greatest, most inspirational Seder in the world. But just not now. Now is not a good time for me. You know, I'm studying for finals, whatever it is. Now, one might take the position, right, and this was a big criticism of the Hasidic movement in its early years, that if the main point of service is to make a connection with God, to feel close to Hashem, to feel spiritual, then, you know, if I could do it better by making a Seder a week later, or if I could do it better, you know, Shabbat, Saturday, just not a good time for Shabbat. You know, just, I got too many things to do, but by Sunday afternoon, I'll be able to make Kiddush and everything else. But, so, in fact, in early Hasidic movement, we do find that what is called the antinomian tendency of breaking out of the framework of legalism. And in fact, we find this in Jewish renewal as well. I mean, you find this, and it pops up in many other... Why do we need these circumscriptions? But the answer is, of course, as Yehuda Levi is going to demonstrate, that ultimately, if one wants to relate to God, one has to relate to God on the terms that God has laid down. Meaning to say, it's not just a game, it's a reality. Meaning, it's not just a game to make me feel good. It is a question of entering into a covenantal relationship. Now, the question then becomes, how are we convinced of the truth of those requirements? That's a separate, what you'll call, an epistemological issue of how do we know what we know. But the point is, once we know it, you can never make the argument, gee, I feel better if I do it another way. You see? Because that's a contradiction. You relate to God the way God tells you to relate to Him. How can you say to God, I got a better way? Okay? So, here you have, now again, I understand this doesn't answer the epistemology of it, which Yehuda Levi attempts to answer. More or less, now again, people will discuss whether that's convincing or not, but once you've surmounted the epistemological reality that this is what God has said, then by definition, you can't do it another way, because it's not a game, it is a reality of God speaking to you. And this carries into a lot of things. In fact, this is one of the issues, without getting overtly political, why dialogue on theology is a notoriously difficult enterprise, whether we are dealing with Jewish-Christian theological dialogue, or whether we're dealing with interdenominational dialogue among Jews, because it's not a question of Democrat versus Republican, or, you know, are you in favor of NAFTA or not, in which there could be a role of legitimacy in all points. Theological argumentation tends to be exclusivist in its orientation. And one of the big challenges is, can one develop a true philosophy of pluralism with the exclusivist nature of a theological position? Again, I don't want to get into it, but you can see how difficult it is, because if this is what God said, you know, how am I to say, well, this is what I believe God said, but it's okay, you know, you don't have to do that. You know, how do you admit of that position? And in its extreme point, this caused many of the religious wars of the Middle Ages. I mean, this was the Crusades. This has, in fact, caused a lot of bloodshed, because, indeed, if this is what God said, I got to do it. Right? So this creates real, real dilemmas. But the point is, the philosopher basically says, God doesn't give any commandments. God exists, but God doesn't care what we do. God doesn't know what we do. God is not involved with what we do. And the best you can do is kind of link yourself to that cosmic intellect by contemplation, by philosophy, by meditation, and by living a virtuous life. Although it's interesting, it's hard to know why virtue fits into that paradigm if God himself does not know or care what's going on. But this is the what's called kind of an antinomian view of religious experience, stressing the subjectivity of religious expression, and therefore not predicating anything on mitzvot, on commandments. And as I say, one of the unique characteristics of Jewish mysticism, which for a short time Hasidic veered away from, was that Jewish mysticism was very unique in not being antinomian. So, for example, the Jewish mystics were extremely committed to halakha, and not only that, but they saw in halacha what might be called omni significance. So if you look at the writings of the Ari would say how each letter, each word, each movement had meanings upon meanings upon meanings upon meanings, rather than say, let's throw out this whole edifice, because the main thing is the subjectivist experience. Jewish mysticism actually took the view of the omni significance of the mitzvot in a much more almost obsessive way than even mainstream halacha, which is kind of a unique phenomenon in mystic traditions. As I say, the only exception to that was the very beginnings of the Hasidic movement, which tried to break away from the halachic structures, and the Vilna Gaon, through his excommunication, kind of beat them back into submission, and the Hasidic movement never really attempted that again. It kind of went back into the mainstream.
Just
want to
know,
one example still exists today. This is the one example that the Vilna Gaon was not able to totally change, and that is the idea of not reciting the prayers and the morning Shema at the right time. There are certain Hasidic groups to this day. Now, what does that mean? The Torah says there's a commandment of reciting the Shema by a certain time. What do you mean you don't recite it by that time? I mean, you're transgressing a positive mitzvah in the Torah. So their point was, well, the point is, though, that if I get more aroused or more spiritually connected by doing it later, you know, I should do it later. I mean, that's clearly a violation of halacha. But that, I think, is almost the last remnant. But there were other things. Again, some of them were rumors, by the way. You can't really say they were fact, because some of the opponents of Hasidut would accuse them of things that maybe they weren't doing. But there was even the accusation of even improper sexual orgies or relations and the like as a way of expressing passionate love of God. But again, as I say, some of these were unsubstantiated accusations that were made. But there were drinking, you know, there were different issues like that. Drinking, gambling. Okay. Now, the Christian and the Muslim also come, and of course both the Christian and the Muslim, of course Yehuda Levi in a way is setting up a straw man here, he says both of them trace their origin, of course, to Judaism, which will of course be the logical reason to turn to the Jew, and they say, well, God chose the Jewish people and God took them out of Egypt and God gave them a Torah, right, so far so good, but eventually they rebelled against the God. In the case of Christianity, they rebelled by not accepting God's incarnation in a human form. In fact, Yehuda Levi is actually fairly explicit about his understanding of the origin of Christianity, and since then God abrogated his covenant with his people, and he chose us, and we, the Christian world, are the new Israel, as it were, and we are now the chosen people. And in Islam you have a similar type of story about Muhammad, although Muhammad was the prophet, etc. And therefore, in this sense, therefore, Christianity and Islam both trace their origins to Judaism. But they make the claim that at some point the Jews forfeited their right to have that special relationship with God, and it went over to the different nations. Yes.
I was for shopping, and I found this book, Philosophy of the Middle Ages, which is a collection by Arthur Hyman and James Walsh. And it's interesting to skim through a lot of it, pretty dense stuff, but a lot of philosophers of the same period, I wanted to take a look and see how they related to Kuzari. And one thing that relates to something you just said earlier is, first of all, it's a big issue with Averroes. That was essentially contemporary with that the issue of interpreting text allegorically, which is kind of related to, if Jewish mysticism accepts halacha, but makes it an allegory for a mystical experience, and that then treads into dangerous waters. Certainly it goes into dangerous waters as far as at what point are you interpreting the past, where they go. Averroes talks a lot about where it's acceptable to go. Averroes talks a lot about that. He says, in interpreting text allegorically, you must never violate Islamic consensus. It's not very rabbinic. So you have to accept the wisdom of, in this case, the Islamic tradition, and in our case, the rabbinic. That as soon as you go outside that, you've been too allegorical. You don't know which text you can interpret it allegorically.
Right.
They have a lot of the same problems that we were having.
Yeah.
And also what's interesting is that this text of Averroes comes from the Hebrew translation. These texts were very well known, and they were willing to accept a lot of process of thought on both sides.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, if you go to Yehuda Levi, we will see, we'll discuss in a moment whether this is really a book of philosophy at all. One can say the Kuzari is not a book of philosophy, but certainly when you get to the Guide to the Perplexed, Maimonides quotes Averroes on virtually every other page. Maimonides was extremely well-versed and had a tremendous respect for him. He's one of the premier expositors of Aristotelian philosophy and the reconciliation of that philosophy with religious tradition, which in his case was Islam, but Maimonides borrowed on that for Judaism.
Or Kuzari seems to be, I wouldn't say anti-philosophical, but it's anti-Aristotelian.
Yes.
And that's also a tradition within Arabic philosophy at that time.
Yes, Neoplatonism versus Aristotelian.
Yeah.
That's very correct. Now,
disagrees with the larger stream.
It is a work of philosophy, but again, the Kuzari, as I say, is It's a very, very different type of work than The Guide to the Perplexed of Maimonides, which, of course, was written later. The Guide to the Perplexed is a technical, philosophical treatise that uses rigid Aristotelian syllogisms, logical structures, philosophical arguments, uses concepts borrowed from Aristotle, and tries to reconceptualize them in a manner that makes them consistent with the tenets of revealed religion. And Maimonides' goal was to show that you can have your cake and eat it too. You can be, you know, a good Aristotelian scholar, which to Maimonides was the essence of science in those days, and you can be a religious Jew. Okay? And he tries to show how, in fact, all of that works together. Rav Yehuda HaLevi has a certain disdain for that entire enterprise. He says, what creates the compulsion to assume that Aristotelianism is an ultimate version of truth to which we have to reconcile our Torah? Why don't we take the Torah as true? And he develops certain arguments for that. And whatever fits that is fine, and if it doesn't, you know, that's their problem, not mine. He's kind of a very unabashed, proud Jew who doesn't feel the need to engage in a polemical explanation of how Torah fits that. Says, let them fit us. And if they don't fit, then drop them. Now, in a sense, sometimes you get the impression, this is a certain circularity here, in which sometimes you read the paragraphs, and the argument sounds like the following. We're right because the Torah says so. Says, and the Torah, you know, tells the truth. You know, but the counter-argument, is, yeah, I mean, you're right because you say you're right. You're right because your book says you're right. Well, why aren't they right? Because their book says they're right. Right? There's a certain problem here in which, says, we're right because our book says we're right. But if you delve in a little deeper, you obviously see that Yehuda HaLevi is making a more subtle point here. And the subtle point is essentially an understanding of history. And this is the major, major difference between how Maimonides predicated faith, which is based on reason, on intellect, and on philosophical argumentation, and Yehuda HaLevi's predicate of faith, which is on the accuracy of history. Now, this might be a controversial point, particularly in light of events in the 20th century, but his point is the following. His point is, Judaism makes certain historical claims that are unique to any other religion. In other words, we claim certain things happen that other religions don't claim happen. And the things that we claim happened are in effect so preposterous that nobody could have ever made them up. And therefore, if we say that, you know, if our books say that they happened, they must have happened because this is something that could not have been a lie. Now, his argument in particular is, and by the way, this one little part of it Maimonides in fact borrowed, although by and large he doesn't take this approach, and that is, he takes the Sinai revelation. Miracles are a very, very big issue in Yehuda HaLevi. In fact, he puts a lot of stock in miracles. Now, in a way, perhaps this is because King Bulan is a big believer in miracles. King Bulan says over and over again, although this is Yehuda HaLevi's words as well, he says, it does not make sense that God would communicate to a people without doing miracles. So Yehuda HaLevi says, you want miracles? I'll show you miracles. We have the splitting of the Red Sea, we have the 10 plagues in Egypt, we have the giving of the Torah at Sinai, we have the man in the desert for 40 years, we have clouds of glory, we have the well of Miriam. These are things that come from God. They couldn't be optical illusions. A person can't eat for 40 years on an optical illusion. Right? There are mirages, but the mirages don't fill you up. Now, the question is, well, wait a second. So, the assertion of miracle proves divinity? What about Christianity, which has Jesus do many miracles? What about the miracles of Muhammad, right, going up to heaven in the horse? So here is where Yehuda HaLevi gets into the issues of historical verification. And that is to say, there is a distinction between a claim that a miracle happened to one person or a small group of people, and the assertion that a miracle happened to hundreds of thousands of people. And that is to say, I could come back from the desert, and I could say, God did this, God did this a most amazing thing to me. God took me up to heaven, and God told me all of the secrets of the universe. And now I'm here to tell you what God told me. Now, if you trust me, if you believe me, then you may believe what I say, and you may spread the word. So Yehuda HaLevi's argument is that miracles that were only witnessed by a small number of people could indeed be spread, even if they're untrue, because one person makes the claim, and then someone believes him, and then if there are enough followers around, they'll simply believe it second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand, fifth-hand. And therefore, the claim, the unilateral claim of a miracle, is not in itself proof of its existence. However, if somebody were to make the claim that God has appeared to 600,000, not just the men who are above 20, they're a total of 3 million. 3 million people, day after day after day, how do you start that as a lie? In other words, who is the first person that makes that claim? One day I wake up and I say, God appeared to 600,000 of us. God appeared to 3 million of us. And the kid says to me, How come I never heard that before? And the kid will go to their father or their mother. Right? So either lady's argument is that these miracles simply have no logical origin point unless they are true. And therefore, his great argument is not simply that, oh, the Torah says it happened, therefore it happened, because I can say the New Testament said that happened, therefore it happened. His argument is that these, by their very nature, are impossible to originate in the absence of the actual event happening. Because how is it going to spread? Unless there's mass hypnosis, mass hysteria, mass psychotic delusion, it's not going to happen. And therefore, Yehuda Halevi's point, therefore, is that the miracles that the Torah claims happened to the Jewish people is in itself the most powerful evidence that in fact there was a revelation and the like. And now again, it gets very interesting because, I mean, I don't want to be irreverent here at all, but this gets us into the issue of what one might call the big lie phenomenon, meaning to say, is it in fact inescapably true that people are incapable of believing some huge, huge situation, right? Well, one could question it in light of the propaganda of the 20th century. But at least in terms of understanding his argument, he's not simply saying, hey, the Torah says we're right, so we're right. He's making an argument based on the difficulty of falsifying a spectacle that is allegedly said to have occurred in front of millions of people over a prolonged period of time. And that is why Yehuda Halevi makes the point, a very interesting point of biblical interpretation, which the Ibn Ezra quotes in the Chumash, in Rav Yehuda Halevi's name. And that is, why in the first of the Ten Commandments does it say, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt? So the question is, right, the king asks the rabbi, why didn't God say, I am the Lord your God who created the heaven and earth? Creation of the universe is a bigger thing than taking it out of Egypt. And one answer is, because God is trying to establish his unique claim on the Jewish people. And that would be the Egyptian Exodus and not just the creation. And the other answer is, it was the miracles. No one saw. I mean, maybe Adam was one person, right? But Adam also only came in on day six. No human saw that God created the world. So one might say, how do I know God created the world? But there were 600,000 men, 3 million people, who saw and experienced the miracles of the Exodus. And you know, ladies, point is that it is the existence of those miracles that establishes the reality of the situation. Actually, Nachmanides says another point, which is very beautiful. Nachmanides says that, you know, if you take the Aristotelian idea of the prime mover, there's this idea of the impersonal God who created the world, but doesn't really care about it afterwards. God wanted to show, I'm not just the God that made you, I'm the God that is still involved in your lives, the God that still cares. I am the God that is involved in history, and therefore that's the third reason. So we have three different reasons, although they're interrelated. One is that the connection to the Exodus is a special claim God has on the Jewish people. The other is Yehuda Halevi's point, that it is precisely the experience of the miraculous that proves that God exists. And the third is that God wants to show us that he doesn't just create, but he is involved in our lives on a day-to-day basis. Yeah.
So I can answer the question, but I assume that if Christianity and Islam all accept Judaism as the base religion.
Yeah.
So those arguments don't answer the question of, okay, that was then, now
yep.
Jews sinned and they didn't accept Jesus, but he made them not Islamic.
Yep.
What now?
Yep, that's very good. He does not give a completely good answer to that. He simply says the following. He simply says, it's kind of a negation, meaning, we have proof that we were chosen by God. You claim, through the miracles that God did to your people, that God changed his mind. Our claim is, all those miracles are small-scale miracles, which don't necessarily, they don't have any proof. In other words, so essentially, the only thing he does is, he says, we have established our truth. You have not established that our truth has been superseded. Therefore, you have not established the burden of proof to support the change. So, he does not refute Christianity. He simply says, he negates the proof for the alternatives, but he does not prove that they're wrong. In other words, the absence of proof does not mean that someone is wrong, it just means they don't have a proof. So the position that he's taking here is simply that the burden of proof to show a change has not been met. Anyway, a little bit of a weak argument, but again, the Kuzari does say that if God wanted to make a change, presumably he would have made miracles of the same magnitude that established, there would have been another Sinai, or the like. Yeah.
Where similar arguments are made about the records that are apparently known to exist in India.
Yes.
And he says, I believe we have mine information came from a well reputed nation or from
yeah.
the it's hard to not want to apply the same argument going the other way, to that paragraph. I recall this from a personal experience when I was 10 or 12. Mm-hmm. I was at the radio on Sunday morning, and it was I didn't know what the source of it was.
Right.
It turned out to be some part of Christian scripture that was being read aloud, but it was a description. Well, how could it? Such great numbers of people, all of whom have reported this miracle, how could they be wrong? And I think, what is that, the Messiah?
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I just didn't know what it was, and I couldn't remember.
Right.
And so a great deal of Christian scripture purports to be supported by widely understood to be the case miracle.
There are difficulties. There are difficulties because we argue. On the other hand, there is, I think he would say, there is a distinction between a mass phenomena that is simultaneously experienced by millions of people and a million individuals who claim to have experienced something private. In other words, Right. Now, it's true that in the New Testament, the Rambam has a significantly different twist on this. Rita Levi seems to make the argument that claims of miracles that happen to individuals might simply be false. There is no evidence that they're true. A person could make it up, and therefore. Meaning to say, under his understanding, I don't accept the stuff that Jesus did in the New Testament. I think it's a lie. And that's basically what he's saying. And you don't have the standards of historical verification to support it. Maimonides has a different twist on it. Maimonides has a twist that we can acknowledge that all sorts of miracles can exist because there's things such as magic in the world. There's things such as utilization of what are called kochot hatumah, the powers of impurity. Meaning, Maimonides says, we don't have to deny the reality of these miraculous experiences. But he would say, miracles don't prove a point. Yehuda Levi seems to say, miracles absolutely prove a point. But what he's saying is that we don't have the historical veracity that there were, in fact, such miracles. Yeah.
His argument turns on what is verified, what could be considered to be a possible lie, and what could be verified by large numbers of people to be shown to be historically true.
Right.
But what he doesn't seem to do in the first essay, I've got too much further than beyond it, is to begin to determine what the interpretation of what is seen would represent.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, it's no longer a matter of whether one person is lying and the other person is telling the truth, or whether a bunch of people got together and some sort of a cabal and said, well, this is the way it happened, even though it didn't.
Right.
But rather, what was the relationship between what they thought they were seeing to what actually occurred?
Mm-hmm.
There are things that occur in nature that cannot be that can be explained, let's say, by modern science.
Yeah.
There's a famous story of Wittgenstein, who was somebody was talking to him and said that we know that the people looked at the world and saw that the sun went around the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And Wittgenstein said, well, how could they have believed that? And the person said, well, that's how it looked. I said, well, what would it look like if it looked like what it is? We can look at the same phenomenon and suddenly interpret it completely differently because of our view of the world. That seems to be. I think that Aristotelianism is an attempt, a remarkable attempt, to interpret questions like that, and what Kuzari does is simply not accept that that mission of philosophy at all.
Well, once again, if the ultimate reality is defined by God. And then the Kuzri, if you recall, discusses the idea of the greatness of Moshe and the prophets. In other words, their godliness, their supernatural abilities, Moses' ability not to eat for 40 days and not to sleep. So if you look at that as an indication of kind of a super person who is closer to an angel, then that itself would vouch for the accuracy of the message and interpretation and spin, as you were, that he puts in that reality. So that's part of his argument again. But again, you know, in a way, I frankly have a lot of problems here because, you know, because we say, well, look at Moshe. Moshe was A, B, C, D, and E. Well, so, well, look at Jesus. He was A, B, C, D, and E. You know, the question becomes, what is the point? In other words, how do we know Moses was that way and Jesus wasn't that way? How do we know that if there are claims? Now, again, if his claim is the revelation of Sinai, that's a different argument because that was something that was witnessed, was experienced by 3 million people. And the Kuzari's thesis is that it would have been impossible to make up that story. Because who is going to believe it? They didn't hear it from their parents. Like, who's going to be the first one? That's his historical argument. But when you're dealing, well, I guess what? It goes back to what? 3 million people perceive Moses that way. But there is a problem. In other words, the reliance on history, well, the Yehuda Levi felt history was a better barometer than philosophy. Because history refers to events that happened and not speculation as to what the logic should be. And this is really, in fact, if you had to summarize the Kuzari in one sentence, the one sentence is, Emunah is grounded, faith in God, and Torah is grounded in historical reality, not philosophical speculation. And in fact, he makes another point later on in the book, that it would be impossible to discern the will of God by philosophical speculation, because there might be an infinite number of things that God wants, and there's no a priori logical way of figuring that out. And therefore, that itself would require the idea of revelation. Now, that itself doesn't prove that our revelation is the truest. Again, see, these are different strands. That goes back to the historical experience, but it does prove that there has to be a revelation if we posit that God wants to have a relationship with human beings.
Come on, let me see. Talmud, there are many, many stories of people doing some of their miracles that mean bad politics and things like that. Mm-hmm. And thereby, even granted, let's say, did those things, it's no big deal because it goes for one time and that doesn't come out of your thing.
Well, let's put it this way. All right, so let's assume that since, you know, a lot of people can do miracles, well, there wasn't a lot of people around.
There are stories about, like, Creon and Mysterium.
Yeah, but wouldn't you assume that that would at least be a sign, if not of divinity, let's say, not of, and one is God, but that would at least be a sign of some level of approaching prophecy or holiness or greatness? In other words, would that commit us at least to the proposition that Jesus was a great tzaddik, you know?
Because he's by knowledge. I don't know how great the person is, but it seems to be some sort of sign.
Well, okay, you know, that is a possibility. Again, that's my, I mean, a lot of these make that point, that there is a certain technical mastery of wizardry and the like.
Oh, my mind
is interpreting. You go to the, read Harry Potter, you go to the Hogwarts School of, yeah.
Because my mind is interpreting these stories in the Talmud,
and not literal. No, but he also says in other places, he acknowledges the fact that there are forces like magic in the world, which can be used. And in fact, in many rabbinic traditions, you know, there's a very interesting book you might be interested in getting. It was written by an Anglican cleric, Hereford. It's called Christianity in the Talmud and Midrash. Because a lot of passages were censored in the Middle Ages. And, you know, he has many, many passages. He actually gives you the Hebrew and then he translates them. In which, you know, there is reference to the arts of black magic and sorcery and the like. So we acknowledge in our tradition that all sorts of people can do miracles. But the point is, you know, he doesn't seem to be going in that direction. He seems to say, you know, miracles are pretty good proof. Yeah.
But Jesus, I don't think Jesus himself claims to be God.
No, not at all.
Only after the fact, trying to become 100 years later, that they something considered him as a
God. No, yeah, that's very true. And in fact, it was a relatively close vote. There was a breakaway from Christianity as a result of that. Yeah, but nevertheless, Jesus' claim at a minimum was that he was a Mashiach, a Messiah sent to redeem his people, as other people claim to be Mashiach over the years. And the idea of miracle, at the minimum, as Yudha Levy says, connotes the notion of closeness to God. It connotes prophetic inspiration. So what bothers me is that if you're putting so much stock in miracle, then even if we would absolutely reject the idea of God taking a physical form, which was a later issue that was not Jesus' claim at the time, but shouldn't at least commit us to the idea that he's a great, great righteous person, etc., you know, which is not our common understanding of the tradition. But, you know, but as I say, Yudha Levy makes the point that all of those alleged miracles were done in small numbers. Again, I have not reviewed the New Testament recently. I'm not sure if that is accurate for every single event in the New Testament. Is there no claim of things that were done in front of massive numbers of people? Huh? But what is a massive, huh? Say again? In the New Testament.
The
loaves and the fishes. That was a big, that was a fairly big one, but that wasn't... Well, you know, those things are very different in a sense. When you have this gigantic crowd, you know, with a water line, you know, a good magician could take care of some of that, you know. It's not, you don't even have that real magic, just a sleight of hand could do some of those things, yeah.
So where, in his scheme of things then, what about the here and now? In other words, these are miracles that happen then.
Yeah.
Miracles
will happen? Well, here, he makes some very unusual claims, which again, are kind of startling in their claim. He develops the idea, you know, one of the famous questions is that, you know, King Bulan, who is concerned with the beautiful afterworld that all the other religions portray, kind of complains, hey, you Jews don't give me such a good afterworld as these other religions. So, maybe I'll go with them because they promise me more afterwards. So, you know, maybe he makes a few points. First of all, he says, it is true that in the Torah, you don't have detailed interpretations of the afterworld, but we have rabbinic literature, we have plenty of good stuff that is awaiting you, that's one thing. But then he makes the point that any claim that is based on an afterworld is leaving itself open to an inability to substantiate its truth. Because, as he says, no one has ever come back and said, I have been in hell, and no one has ever come back, or we have near-death experiences, but no one has ever come back, and I've been to Olam Haba. He says, Judaism, he says, makes the bold claim in the Torah, that there is reward for doing the commandments in this world. And he says, and this is always, he says, and if you do the mitzvos, you're going to get reward. If you don't do the mitzvos, you're going to get punished. These are this world claims, and those are miracles. That's a miracle that mitzvah creates blessing, sin creates punishment. Those are verifiable, those are substantiated. The Torah gives you things that you can substantiate. Now, the big problem we have when we read that is, wait a second here. Is that in fact the reality that we do face? In which we do live in a world, which is considered the big question of theodicy, right, justifying, in which why do bad things happen to good people? In which, in point of fact, that doing the mitzvot does not guarantee, and in fact all the commentaries deal with this problem. So, we can have see, there are two questions I'm raising. One question is on the Torah, and one question is on Yehuda HaLevi, meaning the Torah question is, how can the Torah say if you do the commandments, you'll get all this good stuff, if in fact we see that if you do the commandments, you don't always get this good stuff, and ultimately, Chazal say, the real reward is Olam Haba, exactly what the other people say. The other question is, if the reality is indeed the case, that ultimate reward is Olam Haba, then that negates Yudhalevi's argument that the Torah contains internal mechanisms of substantiation by promising this world. Now, in terms of the question on the Torah, we already have a comment of Nachmanides, who lives later, where Nachmanides says, interesting point, he differentiates between the fate of the nation and the fate of the individual. Nachmanides says, the Torah promises that if the Jewish nation as a whole would keep God's commandments, the Jewish nation as a whole would suffer prosperity, blessing, and goodness in this world. However, the Torah never promised that an individual would automatically prosper in this world. Now, of course, there's ultimate reward, but the mystery of why individuals suffer is the mystery of the book of Job. That is the mystery, and there are many, many reasons and possibilities. One is it might be an atonement for the little bit of sin that he has. Number two, it might be to teach a person humility and submission to God. A third, it might be a punishment for reincarnation. A fourth, which might be the most important reason, is a vehicle for transformation and growth and development of qualities that would otherwise be dormant. Here I refer to Viktor Frankl's work in which he talked about the fact that it's precisely the way we react when things are difficult and tragic that has the potential to transform us and elevate us and bring out qualities that would otherwise be dormant and underdeveloped. To take the temporary example, I often think of Christopher Reeve as an example. Right? Here you have a fellow who is talented and wealthy and popular and well-liked, but, you know, on some level superficial as Hollywood culture is, and he suffered an awful, awful tragedy. And he writes about the fact that he couldn't even kill himself. He wanted to kill himself, but he couldn't kill himself. He was paralyzed. He wanted his wife to kill him, pull out his breathing apparatus. But now he is really a source of inspiration and courage and showing people how you have to go on. And although we don't wish this tragedy on anyone, but I think he would say himself that he's become a different person as a result. This is what Viktor Frankl talks about, the transformative effect of suffering. But the point that Nachmanides makes is that the promise of the Torah, that there will be prosperity and peace, is a promise made to the nation of Israel. Now, suffice it to say, the nation of Israel are not keeping, as a nation, we're not keeping the mitzvot. Most Jews don't keep the mitzvot. So consequently, the fact that there are individuals who are suffering is no proof against the Torah at this point, because the Torah never made the promise to the Yahid. The Torah made the promise to the Am. This is the idea of Nachmanides, that there is a difference between the fate of the nation and the fate of the individual. The fate of the nation is bound with the blessings and the curses of the Tochacha, but the fate of the individual is the ultimate mystery of Tzadik Baralo, that the righteous may be suffering as well.
There are rewards for mitzvot, and he says they will always happen. But again, and the problem is, you know, what do we deal with? How do we deal with the fact that, at least with our eyes, we don't always see them happen? Now, what do we say? Well, it'll happen, you know, it'll happen eventually. It'll happen in hundreds of years. It'll happen to the end. But that is not the type of immediate substantiation that he's talking about. In other words, he's making the point that the Torah has a this-worldly emphasis because that is the only way you can substantiate truth, which you could not if you would predicate it on otherworldly. But the problem is, the spiritual interaction that God has with this world is a much more complicated dynamic. Meaning to say, even on those commandments where God says, for example, if you give charity, you'll get rich. I give charity, I don't get rich. So one answer would be, well, you're richer than what you would be if you didn't give the charity. In other words, to say, well, if you didn't give the charity, you'd be more poor than you are. But the problem is, that might be an answer, but that's not a substantiation. In other words, how do you prove it? Oh, but I will tell you this, I don't want to get into personal revealing details. Because the synagogue rabbi, you know, called upon to give a lot to different people. And there were times in which I decided I was giving a little bit too much. And I, you know, curtailed something. But I have noticed repeatedly that a week that I decided to curtail, I've incurred some extra expenses. I can very much try it. There was a concept that giving the charity kind of gets you a little bit some other way.
Yes. This would be very, very interesting, and I should research a little bit more. There is certainly substantiation of the Jews in Egypt, of the existence of Moses, of the people leaving, and a description of various things that happened to Egypt. Now, again, a naturalist could interpret catastrophes in a particular way. You know, you can interpret all the plagues if one is so inclined in a naturalistic way. Imagine if the Red Sea would split today. How Harvard and MIT would describe it. So maybe the New York Times and scientists are still speculating, but a number of theories have been offered. But there is actually external substantiation to many of the historical events that are recorded.
In Egyptian,
in Assyrian, in Babylonian, in a number of cultural texts. Now, they don't necessarily give it the same spin and the same significance or the same interpretation, but there is indeed cross-cultural confirmation. And one of the very exciting things that has happened in archaeology is that for many, many years, the archaeologists have not found any confirmation of things, and they just assumed these were made-up stories.
but we have found in this century a lot of external confirmation. Now, for a believer, we don't need the confirmation per se, but it is a nice thing to have, and it dovetails well with the view of Halevi's idea that history is a prime determinant of faith in God. Well, that's an interesting question. According to Yudah Levi, here's the question. This is the question that we really have. If it is impossible to make up the story, right, that's his assumption, it's impossible to make up the story, and even Christianity and Islam accepted the story, that's really part of his thing also, right? Then how do we get different versions of the story today? Right? In other words, who made up the different version? Now, here, though, we have to, you know, be honest and basically acknowledge that the notion of the divergent narrative of the Sinaitic revelation is a fairly recent phenomenon. I mean, to say, even if you go back to the Karaites, who disagreed with the oral law, right, the Karaites believe in this revelation of God giving the Ten Commandments in front of 600,000 people, the Sadducees believed in it, etc. So, the idea of this alternative notion that the revelation of Sinai did not happen in that explicit, clear way is really a creature of post-emancipation 19th century. And the question then becomes, how did that happen? That's a good question. How did it happen? But the point is, it happened in the past 150 years, 200 years. And, again, since I affirm the Levi's description of how it happened, I can't necessarily speak for the alternative readings. But they are recent, meaning these are not co-extensive alternative understandings of what happened that go back thousands of years.
Because everyone agrees that at least what happened is that the Ten Commandments.
Yes, Yehuda Levi is not referring at this point to the entire Torah.
Thank you.
No, let me explain this. Because what happens on the day of the Sinaitic revelation, Shavuot, was not the giving of the five books of Moses. It was not the giving of the oral law. That was a process that took place over 40 years, etc. What happened on Shavuot and the Ten Commandments? Now, if one takes the position, I don't believe that God communicated the Ten Commandments, that is an alternative vision of reality, which has only surfaced in the past 150 years. That would not be the historical vision, as Jews believe, as most Jews believe, for thousands and thousands of years. Okay, so this is his big point. His big point, once again, is the idea of history, and basically, Yehuda Levi says, the greatest evidence of God is what God has done, God's actions. And if those actions are described in a certain way, and the probability of their being falsified is minimal, then you can assume that God did them, God exists, God chose the Jewish people, God gave them a Torah.
I thought, I'm not sure if I understood the answer when I asked that before. So that's based on history, what God did.
Yep.
So what does God do now?
Oh, okay. Well, he doesn't say at this point. I mean, but I'll tell you, I mean, his argument is that God doesn't have to do a miracle every day. Nachmanides makes the same point. That if God did these things, and now we're in Galutz, and now we're not deserving of those miracles, and now we're not in the land of Israel, etc., so we don't have that type of connection to God. But that doesn't negate the reality of the situation. Now, on the other hand, although I don't think Yehuda Levi makes this argument here, but other Svarim make the argument that Jewish survival in Galutz is in itself a miracle of the same or greater magnitude than the Exodus of Egypt. Mark Twain wrote this, I'm sure you've seen this, in a famous essay in Harper's Bazaar, published in the 1890s. You know, Mark Twain is a landsman of mine. I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, but Mark Twain spent his adult years, came from Missouri, but his adult years in Hartford. And Mark Twain, who was not Jewish, of course, writes, I think he was accused of an anti-Semitic reference, he wrote a whole essay in defense of the Jews, and he wrote about the miracle of Jewish survival. This is, of course, pre-Holocaust, but this is before I think that they make the miracle even greater, in which the greatest nations of the world, Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, all tried to destroy this little nation. And these world empires are crumbled and are in the dust. And the Jewish people have still survived, not just survived, but flourished, and have developed so many contributions to the world in terms of morality and science and wisdom. And he felt this itself was a great, great miracle. So the truth of the matter is, you could also say, in fact, the Holocaust, which raises the tremendous theological question of where was God, right, a difficult question, but we also have to recognize that if the Holocaust poses such difficult theological questions, the ability of the Jewish people to recover after the Holocaust is also a miracle of a great, great magnitude.
Well, I guess the question I'm asking is, where does he place God in this interaction? That was, if God is a God of history and
that proves,
everything that there is a God, what's the interaction?
No, well, he's not positing that the only way God can connect with his creation is by miracles. He's not positing that. Rather, a miracle is proof that he's there. Even the Hebrew word miracle is very instructive. The Hebrew word for miracle is nes. Now, the word nes means a banner or a flag. Like it says in the Amidah, Tekah b'shofar gadol l'chayutenu, blow a shofar for our freedom. Tesa nes, lift up a banner. So what is a banner? A banner is to simply call our attention to what's there. So God does miracles to remind us of his presence, so we don't take it for granted. But the real point, which Nachmanides makes very beautifully in a number of places, the real point is to recognize that all of life is a miracle. All of life is a gift. But occasionally, God breaks the bounds of nature to get our attention. But he doesn't have to do that every day. Right? You don't have to do it every day. First of all, God would do a miracle every day. Miracles would become nature, and then it wouldn't be a miracle. It wouldn't be a play, for sure. So he's not saying that, you know, the only indicator that God is here is miracles, but miracles are the flags that prove it.
My mind is different from
In fact, it's very interesting. There's a statement in the Gemara, very interesting, about a man who was widowed. His wife died, and he had a baby, and he had no way of feeding the baby. And God caused his breasts to produce milk, and he was able to nurse his child. So there were two rabbis discussing the story. One rabbi said, "What a wonderful man this must be! What a tzaddik he must be that God made a miracle for him to feed his child." The other rabbi had a very negative attitude. He says, "This is a very, very bad situation that God had to change the whole operation of the universe just to accommodate him. In other words, he should have done something else. He should have gotten a job. He should have borrowed money. He shouldn't call upon God to change the structure of the universe. Because God makes the world the way he wants to make the world. And as you say, the miracle, to some way, is a deviation, which God has to respond to because of lack of faith, or God has to respond to because the guy didn't take proper precaution. It's actually a chisorum, a lack, for God to do miracles." And that's why the Rambam says, God doesn't do miracles on demand, so to speak. And in fact, that's why it's brought down in Halakha, that if one is a beneficiary of a miracle, that comes out of their Olam Haba a little bit. That's an extra worldly reward, which diminishes their schar in Olam Haba. Yeah. Yes, who are not the professional philosophers, they are not of the philosophical sophistication of the Rambam's audience, but they are people who are beginning to wonder. In fact, if you notice, the subtitle of the Kuzari, and this is Yehuda Levy's subtitle, is Defense of the Despised Religion, Despised Faith. That is the subtitle of the book, and the concept of the inferiority complex that many Jews were feeling, you know. Is our religion as good? After all, we look in the world, and we see the growth of Islamic power, we see the growth of Catholic Spain, well, no, there's Islamic Spain, but Catholicism in France, and we see Jews as being downtrodden and oppressed and rejected. And really, this is kind of a session to climb Jewish pride, to recognize the goodness of Torah, faith in Hashem, of mitzvahs, of reward. And he even presses this, although it's kind of incongruous for him, and he goes, to be talking about all the rewards of this world. But he wants to say, if we would just keep as a nation Hashem's mitzvahs, there would even be reward in this world. So he clearly is talking to Jews who I think already committed to faith, but to find it being attacked, and find it being weakened, and find themselves wondering whether it's worthwhile to keep this up.
It wasn't the impression that he
Yeah. Well, you know that basically he is against anything. You know, he says, we don't have to borrow from them, and Hebrew is better than Arabic. I mean, basically, he goes through. Well, of course, he did as a professional, but he basically asserts the superiority of Hebrew to other languages. That'll be in the second day. But you're correct. I think he is disturbed by the tendency of regarding everything out there as good, and you kind of have to apologize for Judaism, and you have to show that, oh yeah, Judaism is consistent with everything that is out there. And he says, no, let's look at Judaism from within, and we don't have to accommodate the rest of the world. I mean, this is, but clearly, he's not dealing with professional Aristotelians, people in this sense.
Well, basically,
there are a number of points he makes in this first essay, although he develops many ideas later. He develops the idea of Judaism as great greater than history, that's one thing. He develops very, very openly the superiority of the Jewish soul, he says, I'm quoting him, I'm asserting right now. He says basically that Adam was the perfect human being, well, he made one mistake, and there is that godliness, creation of God, and the godliness gets passed down selectively to the descendants of Adam. And he uses the analogy of fruit and peel. In every generation there is the fruit and there is the peel of the fruit. And eventually the fruit was Abraham, and Abraham himself had an Ishmael, etc., and it is only Yaakov and all of his children who were the ultimate fruit that bears godliness. He even makes the very surprising assertion, and again, this is very, very difficult to deal with, but he says it, that even a convert to Judaism cannot achieve. This is a real lady's view. As far as I know, this is not halakhically accepted, but his own view was that even a convert to Judaism could be a righteous and good person, but could not obtain the level of prophecy, which is the highest level. Again, and we shouldn't feel too bad because none of us are prophets either. I mean, it's not like, you know, I tell a fake convert, hey, you know, you can't be a prophet. But he does make the point that there is a glass ceiling, as it were, that unless you are genetically and biologically Jewish, there's a certain quality in the soul that left. Now again, this is very... Well, that's true, that's true. In fact, the truth of the matter is, many of us may be descendants of David. Now, again, this is very hard, and again, I'm not going to defend it here. This is very, very hard for the modern year to hear, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that there are ideas that he is advocating that are dissonant and do not ring true to the egalitarianism that we tend today to bring to religious expression. But just in terms of the history of ideas, it is important that you at least be aware that this is Rav Yehuda Halevi's view, that there is something special, unique, irreplaceable, holy to the Jewish soul, and whether that Jew is keeping the commandments or not, there is an innate quality of godliness and spirituality as compared to the non-Jewish soul, and that cannot be fully overcome even by the process of conversion. Yeah. Well, when I get to a missionary, I don't think it's productive really to engage in dialogue or giving them things that they could read. You know, I remember years ago in Baltimore. I mean, when there was a concert that was organized by Jews for Jesus.
They just set up shop here.
Oh, they did here.
Another street.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the groups in Baltimore actually had a lot of religious kids buy tickets and go into the concert, not to heckle, but to go over to people who look Jewish and kind of offer them, you know, literature and classes and things like that. So I remember, as I was young, I went over to a guy who looked Jewish. I asked him, "Is he Jewish?" "Jewish." This is what he did. I would never do this today. And we started getting into a discussion. I was really happy when he wanted to know about Talmud classes. He wanted to know about the Talmud. He wanted to know about the Midrash and the Chumash and the interpretation of the verses in Isaiah, you know, the suffering servant. I was really so proud of myself that, you know, he gave all this information. It turned out that he was the head of Jews for Jesus in Maryland, and he just wanted to know all of the ammunition. You know, he just wanted to know all that we're saying, so he would be able to refute it, supposedly on his terms. So sometimes engaging in these types of dialogues are not helpful. I would not suggest rudeness. I don't suggest, you know, slamming the door, ripping up the stuff, and the like. But, you know, I think, you know, I have my faith, I'm committed to my faith, and I'm not interested in discussing the facts on it. You know, in Mayor Shelley, when I was in the show, it was a big scandal. Apparently, a Christian missionary family moved into Mayor Shelley. You know, a strange place to move in. They were over a bunch of tables on Mayor Shelley Street. And, again, I'm not defending the reaction, but, you know, Mayor Shelley, you know, there tends to be a lot of rioting when things are not proper. And, people broke into the apartments where they were not there.
Aww.
And they destroyed, I think, fax machines and some missionary literature and the like. And the police came and arrested some of the religious people who were doing it. And there were demonstrations every night, because it's like the city, so there was a little bit of police brutality in terms of how they dealt with the religious people who did something that wasn't right, but the police overreacted to show that, you know, they would protect Christians and the like. So even in the middle of the most religious neighborhoods, these dangers do happen. But dialogue and argumentation are not a good way to go. The one thing we can learn from missionaries, though, is that we should not be ignorant of our Tanakh. It's really a shame that you know, even people who are observant and fairly learned are often not familiar with the book of Isaiah, right, etc. They wouldn't be able to. So a missionary may have 12 verses that they know well, and they go, "Oh, how do you say about Isaiah, you know, 11 right there?" And, you know, often people don't have a response. So it does, you know, it is incumbent on a person to at least investigate what their own Tanakh says, so they understand. Like, the famous example is the reference to virgin, right? In Hebrew, the word alma is not virgin. Alma is a young woman, and the reference to the young woman giving birth is not a reference to Jesus at all. It is a reference to Ezekiel, because we all know he's the up-and-coming king who would be a righteous king that would protect Jerusalem from Sakaya. But a lot of these events are not even messianic prophecies. They are referring to short-term historical events.
Genetic in the sense that it's...
Because we know by most commentaries explain it's genetic.
Well, I don't know what you mean genetic. Well, genetic is something you have to have gotten from...
That he was physically different than a normal person. Would that help him to...
I'm not sure if the lady is using an actual physical argument, but he's certainly talking about at least a spiritual quality of the soul. Now again, this was one of the most controversial teachings of the lady, and that is the innate spirituality, spiritual superiority of the Jewish soul, and this was adopted. The Kuzari, by the way, was greatly beloved by the Hasidic movement. Loved the Kuzari because it actually tied in to the Baal Shem Tov's teaching. It's interesting, you don't realize the downside of the Baal Shem Tov's teaching for the modern. What was the Baal Shem Tov's great teaching? there's many great teachings. One of his great teachings were that even the ignorant Jew who is not learned, who has not accomplished very much, is beloved and precious in the eyes of God. There is something special and unique about every Jew, no matter how spiritually impoverished he seems to be. Right? That's the great Baal Shem Tov's argument. Right? That's the beautiful teaching of the Baal Shem Tov, which gave encouragement to the downtrodden masses who were not learned. But keep in mind that that's really the flip side of the Kuzari, Jews are bitter. Right? And that's basically it. So you see that ideas can come across as very benign and encouraging and comforting on one level, but they also have a little bit of an edge to them on the other side.
Just a quick point, Matthew, what Rossi mentioned, speaking about who was the audience, even how lady wrote this back in the middle of the crusade, when it was the whole confluence of the Christianity against the infidels of Islam and Jews, and for the destruction on those two Jews, this could very well have been to the degree that it was called the despised faith. So that would help him be involved in the evil, to be able to understand it much better.
Yeah, that...
Well,
I'll tell you this, it's very interesting point. Now, I just heard on the radio just coming here, and on NPR, there was, I guess, part of it, I don't know what the occasion was, but this was discussing Felix Mendelssohn. Felix Mendelssohn was the composer, who was the grandson of Moses Mendelssohn, right? And Felix Mendelssohn, as you know, converted to Christianity. Well, what I heard was, the story was that he was convinced to do so. He didn't want to do it, but he was told, listen, if you truly believed that this was God's will, if you believed this was the will of God, then indeed you have to be willing to undergo any indignity, any suffering. But if you don't really believe, then it's an evil to your children to condemn them to a life of deprivation. It is actually a moral wrong to affirm ethnically to a religion just because it's your tradition. If that's going to cause your family pain and inconvenience and suffering, if you no longer believe that this is the will of God. And in a sense, you see, this is what's going on here as well, in a more extreme way. That is, if Jews are being massacred, if Jews are being killed, if Jews are being tortured, and after a while, a person begins to ask, do I really believe this? If I don't really believe this, why am I going through this? If there are ways out. The Crusades were different than the Holocaust. As you know, the Holocaust, you didn't have a way out. You could convert to Christianity, you could be a nun in a Carmelite convent, and you could still go to Auschwitz, and you could be canonized years later for that. But in the Crusades, there was a way out, right? If you're too converted, you can convert. So there is this kind of need to build up the faith in times of adversity and torture. There's no doubt that I'm sure it was connected to that.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very interesting point, that you're talking to the convert and saying, you can never be one of us. But, maybe the Boulans appreciated the honesty.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that he could have said at the end was that, even though they knew this, it was such a tough thing for them to come in.
Well, if you remember, it's reminiscent of a passage in the Gemara, where a convert went to Hillel, the famous story, he's going to tell on one foot. But there's another story, that a convert said, convert me, so I'll become the Kohen Gadol. I want to become the Kohen Gadol. So again, Shammai kicked the guy out. Kohen Gadol, you can't be a Kohen Gadol, you're not a Kohen. But Hillel said, okay, let's start. He goes, Aleph and Beis and other things, and eventually he teaches him the law of the Torah. He learns all of the Torah, and he's convinced of its wisdom and beauty. He then knows he can't be a Kohen Gadol. So sometimes you have to indulge a person's fantasy a little bit, and then when he sees the whole system, they can live with that also.
Have there been any other groups that also converted to Judaism?
There were a few groups. This was the largest group. Going back in the Roman Empire, people wonder, why were the Romans making such a big deal about Jews? The Jews were not a little nation. But the truth of the matter is that there was a lot of conversion to Judaism in the declining years of the Roman Empire, and it was estimated that up to 10% of the Roman Empire, which at that time was tens of millions of people, there may have been as many Jews, and many of them were converts, as there are today. So Jews were a real problem. They were a real problem to Rome. So there was much more proselytization. That's a historical issue, but there was much more conversion to Judaism than we assume. Yeah. Well, that is interesting. I think it just shows you that the idea of positing a superior person can lead to dangers. But our answer to that would be that the Jewish notion of superiority, even as Yehuda Levi articulates it, also connoted greater responsibility and obligation. It was never the idea of, I'm great, therefore I don't have to do certain things. It was the opposite. I'm great, and therefore I have responsibilities to bring holiness and goodness into the world in accordance with the laws of the Torah. So the notion of chosenness, as controversial as it is, ultimately takes a benign direction in the sense of responsibility and obligation towards others. But still, I understand. I understand how This is hard for many people, but nevertheless, this is what he says, and one should look at it, think about it, internalize it, see what they can accept of it, and what is difficult for them. There's another point Yuval Levy makes, however, later, not in this part, in which he points to the fact that there are four classical levels of existence. There is the inanimate object, there is the plant, there is the animal, there is the human, and these are four different levels of creation, and then there's the Israel, the Jew, that's a fifth level. But he makes a beautiful point. He says the following. He says, you will notice that when something disintegrates from the realization of its level, the higher the level, the more repulsive it is in its disintegration. A rock is neither dead or alive. A rock is always the same. But a dead plant is not as repulsive as a dead animal. Right? And a dead corpse, a human corpse, is more repulsive in some ways when it decomposes than an animal. So he wants to say, therefore, just as a human that has not realized its potential of humanhood, humanity, is on some level worse than an animal, a Jew that has not realized that element of uniqueness in his Judaism, in effect, is beneath a human being. And therefore the concept is, the greater the potential, the greater the emptiness and vacuum that is created when that potential is not realized. This is reflected, by the way, even in Halakha. And that is, in Halakha we have rules about Tumah, like certain things are spiritually impure if you touch them, and Tumah is connected with the vacuum that is created when there is death. Death creates a vacuum, because there was a certain potential for holiness that existed, and death is the vacating of that holiness. So according to Halakha, it's very clear that a dead animal conveys much less impurity than a dead human being. So if I touch a dead animal, I'm only ritually impure for one day. If I touch a dead corpse, I am tamei for 7 days. It's also true that a Jewish corpse conveys a higher level of impurity than a non-Jewish corpse. In this sense, a non-Jewish corpse conveys tumah only if I touch it. But a Jewish corpse conveys tumah even if I'm in the same room with it, or in a cemetery, or the like. In fact, this was a mistake the Arabs made. If you recall, in Jerusalem, the Golden Gate overlooking the Mount of Olives is the other side of the Kotel, the other side of the mosque. So that's a sealed gate, and legend has it that that's the gate that Eliyahu HaNavi will come from the Mount of Olives and bring Mashiach through that gate. So you may recall that there's an Arab cemetery right up to the Golden Gate. And the story goes, the Arabs are familiar with the Midrash that Eliyahu HaNavi is Pinchas, the high priest Pinchas. Pinchas is a Kohen, so they figure if they build a cemetery up to the Golden Gate, Pinchas will not be able to go through, will not announce the Mashiach, and the Jews will not be redeemed. But the Arabs were very well versed in the Midrashic literature. They actually were. They knew all these different stories. But the reason the Arabs are not correct on this is that it being a non-Jewish cemetery, a Kohen is allowed to walk through a non-Jewish cemetery as long as he does not touch any corpse directly. And therefore, Eliyahu HaNavi will be able to go through. The truth of the matter is, I very much doubt that little cemetery would have made a difference. Eliyahu HaNavi would take another gate if he had to. It wouldn't have to be that gate. Hashem is not going to say, well, Mashiach can't come because the Golden Gate is... Well, the question is how high the gate. But the thing I want to make is this. The point is, however, you see from this that Tumah, which is the vacuum that is created when life is no longer present, is a function of the potential for holiness that existed. The greater the holiness, the greater the Tumah. So in effect, this highlights the idea that the chosenness or the innate spirituality of the Jewish soul creates enormous obligations and responsibilities, and when those obligations are not met, the person may descend to a level that is even worse than that of the animal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, as far as I can read you that lady, he does not say there are any entitlements per se. In other words, he mentions a few. He mentions the land of Israel is the entitlement that God gave to the Jewish people. That is the Holy Land, and the Holy Land belongs to the holy people that were sanctified by God by the quality of their soul. He talks about prophecy, the capacity for communion with the divine, and connection with the divine. Yes, those are the spiritual privileges of the holiness of the Jewish soul. But he does not suggest, at least here, any idea of temporal rule over other people or control over other people or domination. He does not perceive that as the Jewish mission per se. These reflect themselves in spiritual advantages coupled with Eretz Israel, which is his, again, we will see particularly later on in the book, that Eretz Israel was very, very special to the country. In fact, he uses the idea that every land, famous passage, every land has its natural products. Right? Some lands are better for sugarcane, some lands are better for, the soil is better for wheat. Right? Every land, soil and climate. So he says, the land of Israel produces prophecy. Because that is the natural product, but you have to have the right plant. Right? Just like not every plant will grow in every soil. So the Jewish soul is that plant which will flourish and grow in the land of Israel, ultimately be connected to prophecy and divine inspiration. Okay, what time do you have to do it? Okay, I just want to say, I think we'll spend just another 2 weeks on it quickly. So why don't you look at the second essay? I just want to warn you about the second essay. The second essay goes on things which are very, very far afield from technical philosophical issues. He discusses two of them, you know, you don't understand everything, that's okay, I don't understand everything either. He discusses some aspects of the uniqueness of Moshe HaKodesh, Hebrew. And you see, by the way, this is a Yuval Levy, the poet speaking, because he has a lot of fun with nuances of language and meter and rhyme, things that a poet would appreciate. And then he has a very complicated discussion about the international deadline and when does the